five, you gotta move, I guess, the way this building, you couldn't stay there. It could be argued, and I think some of the witnesses from Roseburg made the point, is it could not, it could be feasible that they couldn't move simply because they haven't arrived having enough capital to, you know, to start at five, maybe it's 10 in some cases, maybe it's only two or three in others. It has to do with the volume. So this five employees figure is a little bit arbitrary. That's what you've always told us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I agree it's arbitrary. I think it's the best figure that we can come up with. If it's law, it's written there, and you can't exceed that. I don't see any danger of county governor bodies attempting to break the law and say you can have 6 or 10 or 15.
What about the proposition? It's a little hard to move them away once they're established, but there they find some way to iron them in to let them stay there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I don't see any way around it other than coming back to this legislative body to change the law.
See, we've been spending, in fact, you're working on a bill right now on marginal land, but we've been spending a lot of time talking about how we set the protections on forest land and agricultural lands, and that seeing urban Oregon move into more rural settings, it presents a lot of conflicts with the people who are trying to do good forest practices, or just herbicides, just pesticides. Same true with farming, just general farming practices. It brings a lot of conflict to bear because you have a divergence of community living there. And how do we explain that away? I mean, what control do we have that we encourage more of that, and so they do less farming, and they start to see conflicts, and say, I'm manufacturing something that requires a great deal of air purity, and my farmer friend is out disking his fields, and that type of, and of course that happens all the time, right here in the Lehman Valley, it happens. How do you address that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, we know that we did pass the right to farm legislation last time, and I see no reason why that farm or forest operation shouldn't continue to come under those statutes as far as pollution, too much dust, noise, insecticides, et cetera, et cetera. If the cottage industry was started in that farm or forest area, they're going to have to knuckle under to the right to farm legislation that we passed.
Representative Anderson, in the Roseburg area surveys, was there an average number of employees by the cottage industries that you surveyed? Was five an average number, three, two?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hattie, I am not sure. I would defer to the chamber people or the council of governments people who actually did the survey. I wasn't aware of that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hart, myself, we come up.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Hart. I am the Roseburg area representative with the Douglas County Chambers of Commerce, and my personal occupation is I'm the director of Wildlife Safari. I have with me Mrs. Ethel Dibala. She and her husband operate a cottage industry, and they're now being passed around a sample of the product, of their product. And on my right is Mr. Joe Wilson, who is this year's president of the the Douglas County Chambers of Commerce. I'm here because I was the original guy who brought this idea. Same as to give you briefly as possible the background. We took our daughter on a trip to Ireland, and I happened to run into literature and investigate the operation of cottage industries in Ireland. The problems are different in Ireland than they are here, but it struck me as an interesting idea. There, the government of Ireland is dealing with massive unemployment, particularly in the rural areas, and they have training programs that have encouraged people to go to learn how to develop skills, and they actually spend money training people to do knitting, glasswork, pottery, and so forth in their homes because they're simply not, families are not able to make a living off their land. When I came back, I started attending the meetings of the Douglas County Chambers and presented the idea in December of 1982. And we had been going once a month to the various towns in Douglas County and have visited approximately 40 cottage industries that are in existence now. I would like to just put in your record just a couple of paragraphs of the basis of the recommendations or arguments in favor of this idea. Due to the present state of the Oregon economy, our citizens appear to be in general agreement that it is desirable to find more and better ways to attract capital and people with special skills. Such an effort will tend to increase employment and diversify the makeup of private employment within the state, and particularly in Southern Oregon. Oregon has attracted and continues to attract people with skills in light machine work, artisan crafts, painting, pottery, woodworking, packaging of dried or prepared foods, electronic subcontracting, engineering, architecture, and model building, to name a few. These people move to Oregon because of the opportunity to live in a rural atmosphere where they can enjoy the natural outdoor amenities available in Oregon. They have moved away from the stringent authoritarian atmosphere of an industrialized urban area and will not invest their time and money in Oregon if there are similar restrictions. Despite this desire for the good life of rural Oregon, there is a strong probability that some of these small businesses will thrive and grow to the extent that they will of necessity move to industrial parks. We envision a creative breeding ground where people with energy, ideas, skills, and some modest amount of capital. While a slower process than offering subsidies, it has the advantage of promoting industry and thrift at virtually no cost to the taxpayer. So one of the things that we're hoping that the legislature will recognize is that these things are going on now. These people, in order to continue to exist, they need recognition, and they live in fear that they're in a kind of a no man's land. County commissioners that we talk to are fearful of endorsing or assisting them in any way or controlling them in any way because they worry that this compromises their commitment to the master plan of their county. And what this law does, although I'm not technically competent in any way, but as I see it, it makes it possible for the counties then to regulate this activity in some way. It legitimizes the people to where they're not afraid to come out of the closet, shall we say, and let people know that they exist. They certainly are desirable people. They have skill, they have capital, and some of them, maybe the, I remember one plant in particular, the man makes little springs for the bowling plant. He had visions of going into semi-retirement. It's been successful enough that now he's teaching the business to his son. And in my opinion, as the son develops sufficient skill, he will move that operation to an industrial park. There's no way he would have spent the money to go into an industrial park at the outset. So it's a kind of a breeding ground for developing a new source of employment.
Mr. Turner.
My concern is this. Isn't the concern that they don't give them a chance to start? It's at what point they move the five-person industry that is invested to get to that point. They cross over the threshold, and is there any indication they would have to move? But then they come in and say, look, we just can't move. We just don't have the capital. If they want to put us out of business because they have six employees, we're done. How are you going to answer that? I mean, now will be 10 tomorrow, 15 later on, and we end up with factories all over the farmland. I mean, is that what we're going to be faced with?
Well, the legislature is going to pass a law that restricts it to five people outside of the family, and the way I see it, it's up to the county to control that, to comply with the law.
Well, you see, when we look in our land use plans, there were a lot of exceptions made for rural intrusion. We've made a lot of those exceptions already, and particularly in the heart of the Willamette Valley. And we've a lot of leapfrog development took place, rural residential areas, and people did come to Oregon because it's a good place to live, and because we have, we've done something about the environment. We're also trying to do something about restricting that type of subdivision going on and moving in the rural areas. We've tried to develop some pretty tough actions, so land reserve land. And I guess what I'm troubled with is that when we start down this path, we start to say, okay, we're going to start to make some exceptions to this. You know, how do we, at what point do we know a business could have 40 employees? It may not be viable to move out of that home right at that point. You follow what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do, but I...
And how do we, then our decision is, no, you aren't going to move, we're going to close your business down, or we start to wait for the law, you see.
If you have visited the places we have visited, these people are operating out of a building that was on their farm, and there really is not the space for that kind of employment, and they wouldn't want it anyway. I would like to make one additional point, and that is that the soil, it's an illusion to say that a family can live on the kind of 20, 40, 80, and 100 acre agricultural pieces in southern Oregon. Due to the nature of the terrain and the poorness of the soil, it's simply not possible. The estimates are that it takes 1,000 acres for a family to make a living off of, from a purely agricultural standpoint of view. I don't think these people move here or buy 40 acres and really expect that they can make a living on an agricultural use. They're there. It's functioning, and it's a constructive activity. It's creating jobs, and we just hope that you people have the wisdom to find a way to make it fit into the scheme.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
If I would recall correctly on my visit to Ireland and visiting some of the cottage industries, frequently I saw neighbors coming into work. Well, their youngsters, for instance, women, would come in at the looms and weave while their children were in school, and frequently in excess of five. I recall, more than four or five looms, for instance, being used. When we look to just five employees, our next thought then is, do we assume, let's call it a boutique, for lack of anything else, here in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
If an individual were to have a kiln, let's say, and do some pottery or something, have neighbors that came in during the day, and I guess you could call it a cottage industry, and contributed various other works of art, and pretty soon they had a little storefront in their garage or auxiliary building on the farm to sell their products. I'm then confused if, in fact, let's say 10 neighbors are contributing off and on. Would this, in fact, be a cottage industry in excess of five employees, even though no one day would there be an excess of five people at the site at one time?
Well, I assume you do what I do at Wildlife Safari, which is you calculate, we have, say, 22 people in the winter and 65 or 70 in the summer, but if you average the hours, it produces a net equivalent of 48 full-time jobs. By that, I mean 40 hours a week, 52 weeks out of the year.
That's how you do it.
That's what I would expect would be done, yeah.
And then on the other hand, I think mainly for the committee's benefit, Toffler's third wave, his text, the third wave, speaks to the computerized cottages of today, really. I think this is definitely something we need to look at. Honestly, I think we're going to find more and more individuals staying at home, at their own piece of personal computer at home, contributing to as a bank employee or what have you, 20 miles away, writing software, you name it. So I'm supportive of that.
Well, I would like, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk too about our aspects of it and not what we had planned with our business and with the five employees like we had talked to, has been mentioned. Our property, we have 25 acres, and the way the land lays, the type of land it is, there's no way and the growing season. There's no, we're lucky if we can get our garden to ripe, our tomatoes to ripen and things like that because of the growing season in the area where we live. But we have built a plant. We have, had a variance when we built our plant. It looks like a house. We made it because we look at it from our front window, and so we made it to look nice, and we will eventually get it landscaped so that it still looks like a house. And we would like to be able to hire, even if we hired 5 people, that'd still be less than 40 hours a week for them because we only work we work 3 days a week is all we work. Now, if we could have help come in, we could work longer. We work from 7 in the morning, and we finish usually by 2, and that's Monday and Tuesday, or Monday, and then Tuesday we are through by noon, Wednesday we are through by noon. So, but those hours, ours is piecework. It's all by cut by hand, everything like that. And we have people in our area that are handicapped, retired, that would like to be able just to supplement their incomes a little bit with this. The way it is now, we could have our children, all of them, work there, and that is legal. But we would like to retire, my husband and I, but we can't retire unless we could have some help for our son. His plans, and I think most young people are this way, they aren't going to stay there when they can move into an industrial park and increase their business. I know this is his plans. He doesn't want to stay in this small building. But we could handle 5 people there, which would be a part-time basis.
Would you pardon me, just please, ma'am?
Yes.
The way this bill is written, you see, when we deal in the abstract of what you're trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. we also have to read what the bill says. The bill is not saying what you're trying to convey to us. Let me just give you the examples. First of all, it says 5 people. It doesn't talk about averaging hours. It doesn't talk about a yearly average. It says 5 people. If 5 people work that were non-related to you, over 5 did, let's say you had 6 or 7 people on a piece rate and they came in from time to time, you would be excluded from this bill, the way I read it. And what I'm questioning here is first twofold. First of all, is it wise for us to allow and just say you can go in any zone you want, any zone? The county court has authority to allow for any zone to be violated for this purpose, provided you have 5 employees or less. That's what the bill says. Is that a wise decision? And what you're trying to tell us is that you could have 20 people that come drop in and do piecework or something. You wouldn't be able to go under this bill the way I read it right now. That's what it's written. So I just want you to know that. It's not talking about averaging hours or things. It says employees no more than 5 persons who are not related to the resident. And
Mr. Chairman, on that and hiring, or if you are hired, like if we hired somebody full time, when you hire somebody, you have to pay unemployment. You're registered with the government then of how many employees you have. And if it says 5 employees and you've got 7 registered, then you're in violation right there. So I don't see that it would make, if 5 people, you're hiring, when you hire, that doesn't mean people that are going together either just to quilt or do this type of thing, you know, and that. But where they actually sell, we have no retail. And this would be one of the things that your county would do. Our counties have no retail. So everything is shipped out. And that, our product alone, small as it is, goes through 5 hands before it reaches a consumer. And then if you're hiring people, and like some of them do hire people, I mean, they are hiring, but they're not out in the open, they're not registered with the government as a legitimate business, well, you don't know how many people that they're paying. All right, and that money that's being paid to them, there's no taxes being paid, there's no unemployment, no Social Security, there's no anything going into the government funds.
You mean they're not paying, they aren't following the law now?
Well, if you follow the law, the minute you hire somebody and you sign up that you've hired somebody, then you're in violation. If you're a cottage industry and you're not supposed to be hiring anybody, you would be in violation. So
you mean on the zoning laws?
on the law, period. The way the law reads is you can't hire anybody. If you can have your family, you could have, it doesn't list your family as, you could have 10.
If you were in
a... Your family related.
If you were in an area that was zoned that would allow for this in a city or in an urban setting, the law would allow you to, you certainly are paying income tax. You're saying that they aren't paying income tax or withholding because they're afraid they're going to discover they're in violation of the zoning ordinances? Is that...
Well, one person that I know of, they're afraid that they don't know what to do. They're sort of like you said, no man's land. They want to comply. But yet if they do, then their business is down the drain and they have no way to make a living.
Okay.
They're handicapped people to start with. And when you say five people, that doesn't necessarily mean that we'd hire five people. But it gives you a place, and then by the time you reach five people, for our business anyway, we would be financially able to and ready to move into an industrialized area, industrial parks. When we started, we looked at the industrial parks. There was no way we could afford to get into it. And if we had in 1978 when we started this, we probably wouldn't have made it. But because we had a variance and built it on our own property, and when you own your own property and you're building on that, I don't see that you're going to want to violate it in any way. You want to keep it to hand down through your family, if nothing else, and enjoy it while you're there. And if you have a... If you're doing all the things that would cause pollution of any kind or tearing up your ground and destroying that, ours is right among the trees, and we like it that way. And most of the one, I don't know a lot of them, but the few that I know, they have their property this way. 5 acres are a lot, most of them have that I know of. And that is what they do. They want to keep everything to look and go along with each, to complement each other rather than to detract from your own home.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I think everything has been well said, and I believe we have to face the fact that these things are here. And I think we need a law to put a handle on them, and I think this is basically our intent. And we have to have confidence that our county commissioners and so forth will enforce these laws and get these people on the rolls so we know where they are. We've visited numbers of these people. There's lots and lots of talent out there. They just will not step forward. And I think we're overlooking the fact that we should have these people step forward and be accounted for. Other than that, I really don't have a whole lot to say about it. The number 5 was an arbitrary number. We just picked it because the 40 or 50 different ones that we visited had less than this employees, less than this amount. And we thought it needed an amount, so we gave it the number 5.
There were three areas of concern that I've kind of heard going around here. I think the previous group reacted to some of them. Let me just pose them to you again to make sure that it was a concern that it is not your intention, as I understand it, to build additional dwellings for these operations, but to use the existing dwellings that are okay. Second, you did not feel that if, say, a person was in on farm use deferral, that they should receive farm use assessment for those portions of their operation that were not related to farming. Is that, did I understand that correctly? And the third one, you didn't seem to object to some kind of clarification that there should not be any interference from the home occupation with whatever the zone is. Let's say you're in a zone for agriculture or forestry, that there shouldn't be any interference with people that are with pre-existing, say, agriculture or forestry operations. Is that
correct?
Would you have any objection if we just try to clarify that in the bill, not changing the substance of the bill, but just to clarify those points a little bit? We'll run it through council and make sure so that there's no...
I feel, Mr. Chairman, I feel that if we do get a bill like this, that we are going to have a handle on these people. We are going to get some revenue for it from the county, and that in turn makes revenue for the state and so forth. The way we are now, we visited hundreds of people working like this and lots of talent. We have nothing. We have no handle on them. We have no tax. We have taxes from them, income tax wise, but we have no permits or licenses for these companies. And they would like to be if they could come out in the front. And this is what our intent is, to get these people out in the front, get a catalog of these people so that they can be found. And then our county commissioners or whoever is in charge of these things can regulate them. They won't. I don't think they should get out of hand at all.
Well, on the staff, do you have other witnesses?
One more.
I'll listen.
Thank you very much for coming. We have one more person signed up. Haywood Reed.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Haywood Reed. I'm a real estate broker in Roseburg. In my work, I come in contact with many people who have much talent and are gifted in various ways. They want to do something in a form of a small business some way or other. And it's totally impossible for me to offer them any kind and type of property that they're interested in where they can do this because of the land use restrictions. Many of these people are underfinanced. When they want to start in a small business, they can't go into an industrial park and rent facilities or buy industrial property and have a facility there for them to go because they're starting in at too small a basis. It would totally bankrupt them, they couldn't do it. So they want to get a place where they can get a foothold in. And this cottage industry bill, to me, seems the answer to many of these people where they could, I'm going to say, go into a rural area, and they come to Oregon because they like the rural area to live in, and the type and kind of business that they would be would not detract from the locale which they'd be in.
Mr. Chair, could you give the committee some examples of some of the businesses that your clients have looked to?
I have one man who is in a wood specialties business. He uses mainly the trunks of the trees and the roots of the trees to develop up tables and the basis for the tables, clocks, and other specialty products. Economic-wise, this is all waste material. And by getting it and using it, he does bring in, and it makes an economic impact by being able to give a job to a few people. And then taking waste material, which would make into a beauty for sale. I have one man in that category right now. And we are trying to get a particular piece of property for him. And it meets his needs. There are two commercial type of structures on the property. It has not been used for farming for years. It has not been assessed. The assessor's office has not used it for farming. But just as a rural parcel, it's right near the interchange of the freeway. And at this point, we are asking for an amendment to the comprehensive plan with a zone change to meet the need. The Planning Commission passed it, but it's being appealed at the present time. But a bill such as this would meet the needs of his because he doesn't want to be big. Five employees would be more than he'd probably need. A series of small businesses like this individually don't make very much of an economic impact, but over the state, we get many, many of these businesses, each in themselves with a few employees, And then when we think in terms of the products that they produce, as well as the jobs that they produce, it would make a big economic impact on the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much, sir. Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. We'll close the hearing.
I'd like the other department to testify on this. I'd like to make some inquiries on it. And,
okay.
The other thing, I see some other amendments here, which are something the staff is looking at, which might be all right. The thing that it's hard for me to rationalize how we gear this with the 5-employee management, and I just got to think about that for a while, okay? It'd almost be better if you looked at sales or some type of income generated, because that's what we look at on tax deferral, but I just don't know whether that's, you know, makes any sense, and I'd have to think it out with it, because we look at what certain things generate on a farm for tax deferral. So we look at something that's generated as a result of this and have employees as well as generation of income that ought to be the trigger. That's my thoughts.
Well, we'll put it up again for a work session this week, and we'll get the department in, and I'm also going to have some of their staff to clarify those 3 points that we discussed earlier.
Because I think they make a pretty good point. The only thing I'm concerned with is we start getting in these conflicts, and we've already been through them 1,000 times. Someone says, well, they told me I could go here, and then you arbitrarily set 5, and then I have 6 employees, and now I'm done, and I don't have the capital to move. And
okay.
We wanted to repeal that entire section because we feel it's unfair. It's a section that is being used against our company at the present time on the Umpqua River. However, to be honest with you, we didn't have the votes to repeal the entire section. We feel that it's still unfair. We feel that if you cannot see a way to repeal the section by placing this amendment on to 2320. We would hope that you would at least repeal the portions of the ORS that says not exceeding the net investment as defined in ORS 543-010, or, and down below, the net investment shall be determined in accordance with the provisions of ORS 543-010 to 543-620. These provisions, of course, are the ones that say that the compensation would be net investment less depreciation. So, I think we're going to be upfront with you. We hope that you can see your way clear to vote this amendment and take it to the floor of the Senate. It's fair. We think that it's something that can pass the Senate and can be taken back to the House of Representatives for concurrence.
Mr. Chairman, whenever you get ready to accept motions, I'll make them, but I'll wait until I want to start to check this.
Okay.
I'm going to move dash 8. I'm not going to move the other. So my intention is to move on that.
Okay. Mr. Byrne, do you feel there's some value to the bill itself?
Yes. No doubt about that. We feel
I guess my concern is you were part of the groups that worked out a fairly delicate compromise on this bill on the House side, were you not?
You're correct, Senator, we were.
And what do you think the impact of these amendments is going to have on that delicate compromise?
We hope that it won't have any impact on the compromise, Senator. We don't want to in any way jeopardize the bill.
You think the PUDs will be ecstatic about these amendments?
I can't speak for the PUDs, Senator, but I would imagine there's one that would not be ecstatic about it.
I think that there are, there's some merit to looking at that chapter. I don't want you to get me wrong, but I am concerned about, I don't want to lose the whole issue that's been worked out in this bill. And I don't, and that's a political judgment, not really a policy judgment. That's just the one of my concerns. Are there any questions for these witnesses in this point, Senator Stryker?
Just a comment. And this is the one area of public power law that has always bothered me the most, that when condemnation proceedings are undertaken, that we are not talking about a fair market value for them.
That's right.
We're talking about the original cost,
less straight line depreciation.
Less depreciation. And I don't think that is fair. But the context of the bill, I don't know if the bill would survive, and I like the bill as it is with some other amendments that are coming along. I don't know if Jill has a future with these amendments.
If we could find another bill in this committee, would you be satisfied if we clean it out and put in amended that?
We got another bill?
120, which we do, which we repeal.
It's a Senate bill. We got 472.
Oh, yeah, but Phil, there's no chance on the Senate.
I don't think.
I really think we got it.
Can we come back clean on the House side?
I think that there's a chance that this will pass, because I think the issue has been aggravated even further with the default of the Wooks bonds. The very real threat of something that's occurring, I think, is there. And, Mr. Chairman, you know, if we went into conference committee, I've never, you know, I just think we've got to draw this issue. And I think there is support on, one of the things I've done is try to do an assessment of who would support this if we go about it correctly. And we aren't outlawing condemnation. We're trying to put condemnation on at least they receive just compensation. And God, I just think that's a fair proposal. And the threat of that, and the fact that we do have some utilities, 80% of our utilities are private in this state. If this were to occur, it surely impacts the rates if they can go out and peel off lucrative generating capabilities. I think we've got to bring it to a head. So I guess, you know, not I don't want to be bullheaded, you know, but I feel so strongly about this issue that I just, I think we could sell the situation and sell it in both parties. I mean, in both parties, I mean, in both the bodies of the legislature, because I just think it's fair. Senator Sarkovich, it's a fair proposal. And I think sometimes we get a little spooky, but I've seen some of the public utilities who are saying, oh, well, we want to keep this. Well, I don't think it's fair under any circumstances, okay? I don't see how anyone could not say they should pay fair market value, you know? That's what I meant.
Mr. Chairman, may I interject one other thing? I'm representing Pacific Power, but I also would say that we have small-scale generators out there that are interested in doing exactly what I think the direction of 2320 takes them, developing something. But with this on the books, it's going to be very difficult for them to get financing for development. And I just think that, you know, we're encouraging it in one way and discouraging it by not doing something about the ORS in another way.
Has, other than the issue involving the North Umpqua, has this statute ever been used successfully in this state?
No, sir. Not that I know of.
Do you have questions?
No. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
Oh, we have other witnesses.
Yeah, we have a couple more witnesses. I want to heartbeat words.
Thank you.
We had a sign-up sheet right here somewhere. This bill.
Okay.
Do we have some of the small power producers that wanted to testify on these amendments? Ma'am, why don't you just please step forward, or both of you, if you're together, we'll have you just identify yourself for the record, and then this is here.
My name is Jan Vetter, and I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Small Hydro Association. I'm not specifically a power developer, but I represent several hundred members in the Northwest, about half of whom are. And I did work on development on a couple irrigation district projects with my former employer. What we feel is that you have set up some excellent incentives under your bill in 1981 and again in 2320 in this session, as well as funding the loan program and providing staff in the Department of Energy to promote these facilities. And in essence, by you're not dealing with the situation of the ORS, you're kind of ripping it all out of our hands again. We don't feel it's consistent with the policy that you have taken, and in good faith, many of our developers have spent from $30,000 up to $250,000 in some cases to get these projects at the stages they are, and now all that money could be foregone. I talked with several financiers, both in Oregon and in other areas, and they tell me very straightforward that they're going to pull out of Oregon projects unless something is done to take care of the situation. So there would not be financing available for projects unless something is done with that section of the ORS. Also, I spoke with Dave White today, who's with your Department of Energy loan program, the SELP program, and he also told me that there would be problems concerned with his financing program if that's not corrected. Some of the concepts that may occur in that program would be that they would be able to only finance a portion based on not having a complete cost return, or that they may only deal with micro hydro projects that no one else wants. And that's not really the kind of project that I feel that the legislation had wanted to see developed in Oregon. They wanted good, cost-effective, viable projects that could be planned in increments of development. I think I've given you some written testimony that goes into this a little further, but basically those are the points that the association would like to make, that our hands would be completely tied unless this amendment goes through.
Any other questions? I just have one question. This statute's been on the books for a long time.
That's right.
And I'm interested in knowing how people got financing up to this point, if having the statute on the books is a disincentive to getting financing.
Right, well, the statute has never been used. I understand there was one case where Tillamook took over a turbine generator, but they used straight condemnation and didn't use the statute. Looking into that a little more, I understand that the statute's probably unconstitutional, and that may be why they chose the other approach rather than using this. Also, small hydro was not cost-effective until maybe 3 or 4 years ago when the power rates started rising, and then people started looking at these projects. There are very few projects that have been financed other than through the sale of revenue bonds, and almost all the projects I'm aware of are in Washington State and not in Oregon. All of our Oregon projects are in development processes right now.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is Jack Foltz, and I certainly hope that you will adopt Senator Day's suggestion and repeal. I've owned land in the Deschutes River in Bend for 20 years. The land was purchased for $10,000. I want to develop a small hydro site there, and I spent 4 years and over $80,000 to obtain the necessary licenses. My site is the most environmentally sound of those of any of them on the Deschutes River. The value of the land alone is about $500,000 because since the time that I purchased it, it's been in a commercial zone. I could lose all of this if this this law is not repealed. And that's the land too. They could take that at the price that I paid for it under the terms as I understand it. And Oregonians in general would also lose. First, Oregonians would lose the initiative I and others are willing to spend to develop hydro sites. No one will put forth the effort to develop a site if the efforts can be lost upon 2 years' notice and payment of the original cost, less depreciation. Second, taxing bodies could lose if a project is taken over by a tax-exempt municipal body, such as the city of Antelope. Now, Antelope could step in and take my unit, and they could do that in several other spots throughout the state because, as I understand it, this law does not have any restrictions as to how many that you can take. I anticipate personally paying about $60,000 in taxes, in property taxes, on my project alone to Deschutes County and the city of Bend. This would all be lost. Finally, should a private utilities hydro plant be taken over, its ratepayers would have to pay more for the power to replace that from a lost project. By that I mean, if they take my project, they'll sell their power to the same people that I sell it to. At this point, they would receive the same amount of money that I would. However, they put nothing back in. They don't pay any taxes on it. So your cities and your counties and the federal and the state, everyone would lose. This is really a very unfair bill, and I certainly hope that you'll help us in getting it repealed.
Question? Thank you both very much. Libby, did you want to say anything on this, or either of you folks? Judy, no.
Judith Miller representing Central Lincoln People's Utility District.
it's very difficult to get comments together when I've just seen the amendments. I think I understand what they do. I have not discussed this, an amendment that looks specifically like this with the general manager or the board of directors of my utility. Therefore, I'm not prepared to say that we could accept it in any way. I believe, based upon the direction I've been given to this time, we would not look favorably upon this kind of amendment, particularly to this piece of legislation that we worked so hard on for so long.
Do you think that, is your sense that your directors would not support this kind of change?
That's very definitely my sense. They haven't wavered yet.
Mr. Chairman, would you believe that, is there belief that it is fair to go in and take a private entity and pay under the compensation formula of 610? Do you think that's fair play?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, I don't believe they've addressed the issue directly as fair play. They've addressed it as 50 years of longstanding water, hydroelectric power development in this state, and simply that alone. They've never made any moves to take over any hydroelectric project, and I don't anticipate that they will.
I've heard that argued a little bit here. People are moving in this area. Some public utilities are moving to take things over. We're trying to get low-head hydro underway for private investment, and we're having trouble because they're starting to see moves where public entities are throwing out the threat that they intend to do this. Emerald PUD is cert notice on PPNL on a dam on the North Umpqua. What the legislature, I think, is faced with in an examination of this is, if someone is going to condemn something, at least the private owner should be entitled to a fair rate, a reasonable return on investment, and not confiscation without compensation. And I guess I can understand where you may say that a public entity can do a better job. We took over an ambulance service here in Salem because it was owned privately and it just simply wasn't working. But to suggest under 610, it never has been done up to this time for a lot of reasons, as the previous speaker pointed out. One is low hydro wasn't really cost effective until recently. The fact that there's a real crisis in the public power agencies as a result of whoops and so forth, some are looking at using this statute as a method to take over some private ownership so they can bail themselves out of whoops. That's what some of the arguments being used. Yeah.
Yes.
That may sound outrageous, but when 80% of the customers in Oregon are served by private utilities, if that were to occur, our rates could go sky high because we'd have to replace all those utilities with some generation capability. So I guess 80% of the Oregonians aren't looking forward to the cities and everyone else going out and kind of shopping where they think they can steal something. Because this is a license to steal. That's what it allows you to do.
Senator Day, perhaps you'd be interested in reading the resolution that Emerald People's Utility District did pass by their board of directors. It is available to you, and I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at that yet.
I have a letter demanding that they want to serve notice of takeover.
I think that might alleviate some of your concerns as small power producers.
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Chairman and ma'am, my concerns after reading that statute, every time we get into the statutes and we're, I've been around here 20 years and I do my best to read all the bills, but anytime we open a new section, if I'd known that statute was on the book 10 years ago, I would have gone after it because I don't think it's right. I'm not even one who believes condemnation is necessarily due process per se, but at least if the state is going to condemn, that they ought to pay a fair value. Here, to suggest that this is a fair statute is beyond me. For anyone to suggest that, and the fact it's on the books is a discredit to this legislature and any other predecessor legislators.
I really don't have anything to add. Just one small thing. Last time I was here before, you asked me if my utility would ever intend in the future to condemn anybody's facilities. We've never done that. I don't know that we would ever be interested in doing that, but for Senator Day's benefit, and he can attest, we have enough trouble just trying to build our own facilities, let alone trying to condemn somebody else's.
Mr. Chairman, I guess how I'd respond to you is that if I could pick up a dam that was constructed at 1920 prices and use straight-line depreciation, I'll bet you there's a lot of them going to start to take a look at it if they're in a jam, you know, from investments that they've made that weren't too good. But your assurances, I trust you with my life almost, Libby, but I don't trust the statute. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Can we have a call with the committee, Mr. Chairman?
Well, we never called all but Rod. I think he's disappeared in the sunset, but we should go over
here. Here we are. Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendment stated 62483 to 2320A-8 as identified by my name. I move those amendments.
Okay. Senator Day has moved amendments 2328-8.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think this is more serious than we realize. I think that what these amendments do is right, so that if condemnation is going to be made by a municipality, that they go under the normal condemnation procedures, and that's all we're doing. And I think leaving 610 to, as is would be a mischief maker, and we have a chance to address it. I think it's this type of approach already, one of the representatives who worked on the bill in the House recognized the fact that low-head development is being retarded by private investment because of the threat of this. And I just think it's our duty to try to clear it up, and that's why I'm moving the amendments.
Okay, so further discussion? I would just say on my part that, as I mentioned earlier, I'd be happy to put this into a separate bill. I think this will jeopardize the bill. And I think if you lose the whole bill, we do just as much damage to small hydro or small power producers as we do by leaving the statutes on the books, because you need that kind of assurance on pricing that is in the bill. So I'd be happy to amend it into another bill and support that, but I can't support putting it into this bill, which I think is a result of a very delicate compromise that certainly included utilities who brought this amendment to us.
Mr. Sterk? Yes, on the same theme, I can support the language, but not in this bill. And I would ask that the committee administrator come back to us by Wednesday with a bill relating to energy, a proper relating clause, that we can tuck this into and then have an up or down vote on that issue.
I would concur, and I would certainly have it before you.
We don't have a bill that can do that.
Yeah, Senate Bill
120. Oh, yeah, but the Senate Bill,
we have a bunch of
Senate bills. Well, I'll support the amendments. I don't want to mess up this. I don't want to deal with it in this way. I think we could go out with a straight bill. I'm not sure that, you know, is it the problem that there would not be support on the House for this?
Well,
for this amendment?
I think there would be
support. Well, I do too.
I think it enhances the bill, if anything. It enhances the development of low-head hydro. We had testimony. Hal Burkett, if you'll recall, I've known him for years, has worked in this field. He used to be a DEQ engineer. And he is exclusively working in this area. And he's telling me that this alone threatens any opportunity for us to bring it out. And I think, if anything, it enhances the bill. It isn't detracting from it. I know there's a few public power agencies that say, oh, the hell with it, it's weakening. I don't think it is weak. I don't think that what this is saying is, in the future, we don't have this threat over someone that goes out and invests a couple $100,000 in a low-head hydro. They have a chance to at least realize their investment without some public agency threatening to come in and take it over with stealing it. Because 610 is a steal. It's not due compensation. It's nothing but theft. And that's what this is about. This amendment actually enhances the development of low hydro energy. It can't do anything but. Every bit of testimony
has pointed in that direction. That's why Representative Bradbury was over here talking about excluding a certain amount of megawatts. Well, I guess once you analyze that thing, why would we allow them to do this under any circumstances other than to pay fair compensation if they're going to take it over? I just don't understand it. I think it enhances the bill.
No, I'd be prepared to vote it out today in another, you know, in a bill that can go on its own. And I think I'd certainly vote it and support it and, you know, be a vote on the Senate floor. I really do have some.
I don't think we have a House bill.
We do not have a House bill. I don't know whether the problem in the House committee was because the proposal was to repeal the entire chapter or whether
it may have been. I don't know how to answer that.
Was presented to the House committee.
At least I'd like to make a run at it, and if it gets in conference committee, but at least give it a crack. My gosh, we're in the late days. We put in the Senate bill. You know, I know what you're saying, but I don't know where that ends up. And we're being told to only process House bills, and I think the same over in the Senate or in the House, they're only processing Senate bills. I'd like to make it go anyway, so we don't have.
Let's call a roll.
Senator Day.
Aye.
Senator Pollan.
No.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Byrd.
Aye.
Senator Monroe. Senator Stassfurt.
No.
No. Mr. Chairman,
can we move it in 120?
I'm going to insert notice of minority report on this bill. So when you vote it out, we're going to have a minority report on the floor.
All right. Bill Nader, you want to wait till Wednesday for the end of the bill?
Wouldn't you adopt dash 6 amendments?
We haven't adopted any amendments, I believe.
You want a motion on dash 6 amendments?
Yeah, those are
the exemption for the 2 megawatt facility.
Okay,
you don't need that if you do.
Don't need what if you do what?
If you're going to have a minority council, minority report dash 8, you wouldn't want to put 6 with it.
Yeah. There's a minority report basically when they have both issues out on the floor.
Sure, that's a point.
Okay.
I guess I don't know what you want to do, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to vote, you know, to pull up 120 and put it in and vote it out. I think it's 120, if my memory.
472 is late energy.
Is it 472?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I would rather join the battle on 2320 and waste our time on a bill we know is going to go to nowhere. And so I would resist the inclusion in 120 because I really believe this is the proper place to put it. I think it enhances the bill. I think it encourages the development of private or public low hydro. And I think it has merit, I wouldn't feel so headstrong about it. But,
well, I think the minority report's a good way to go, and we can see exactly where that way we can vote the issues before the Senate, and I have certainly no objection.
Okay.
We're going to get out that way.
Okay, so 227 is the bill that I'm
going to need one more aye vote to get the bill out. And then
I would give you the aye vote to get it to the floor with the understanding that I'm still a minority.
Who's going to sign on the minority report?
Jeanette. Probably all three of them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait until Wednesday to get it out. You have to be noticed.
I guess you do.
Okay.
Top of the minority report, then, would include Dash 8 amendments, so you know.
227.
And I guess it's Senator Hurd, Hamby, and Day.
Okay, now we're going to move to House Bill
2295. Where are we going to keep?
2295.
2295.
What the hell is that? I'm going to wait just a second here.
I got 2295.
Folks, to the right of this.
I got the list of that. Now, $2,395, Mr. Chairman?
$2,295, okay.
What is that strange number, $2,295? Of course not. Where's your pile? Your wings.
Oh, God.
And then you know.
That's how far I've gone, over the hill.
Well, I've gone over the hill, so I lost my pocket.
I didn't know that. I'd say $2,295. Jesus. I even forgot the number.
Is that the one that has 13 plates on it? Is that the story you're going to get everybody to sign up?
Okay, is the sponsor show okay?
Mr. Chairman, would I have time to visit?
Sure, we won't be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
Committee of the Convention will come to its usual semblance of order. What we're going to do tonight is... We're going to start out and go through 2095. We've got left to do a bunch of miscellaneous amendments, the economic development portions, and then a few things to clear up on standing and post-acknowledgement. And I think we'll start with the other. You should have in front of you a little piece of paper that says other.
What?
Wait, it's other. Other. Oh.
State agency coordination.
Yes, I got it.
All right. The first amendment is state agency coordination. Where is that in the book?
The AOI. Home builders amendments are one in your amendments, so I'm not sure exactly.
Number one, and Senator Day's amendment would be in his amendments. Is that correct? Okay, let's have Marianne and is Fred?
I haven't seen
him. Maybe we can have Fred Vanetta.
Okay.
You can speak for a speaker.
As a matter of fact, this is a Marianne Hutton, Associated Oregon Industries. This is an amendment that, although it was included with the AOI home builder amendments, it was entitled only Associated Oregon Industries, and it is submitted only by AOI and not by the state home builders. It's an issue with which we've been concerned. The amendment that was submitted by AOI adds two subsections to the state agency coordination statute. That is already amended in 2295.